Welcome to episode 65 of Frank Reactions, the show where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name's Tema Frank. Things are getting mighty busy around here. First, a little book update with some advice from the folks on my PeopleShock Insiders list. The cover content is now done and off to the designer. If you want to join that list and offer your 2 cents worth as I head into these final weeks before launch, please do go sign up at bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst, all as one word. And if you sign up for that, you'll get sneak peeks at some of the content, you'll get bonus materials, an invitation to the launch party, and a chance to get the book before it goes on sale to the general public. So I'd be thrilled if you went over there, bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst. I'm still hoping to release the book before I head off to the CXPA's 2016 US Insight Exchange in Atlanta, which is happening May 3rd and 4th. And I may be giving a little presentation there if enough people vote for my topic. What they've done is they've set up a category where thought leaders can propose presentations, and it's up to the folks going to decide which ones they want to hear. So mine is called Customer Experience Turnarounds, Strategies That Work. And if you want to go vote, that is at bit.ly/CXPA Thought Leaders, no spaces between the words. So head on over there and vote. I'd love to get your support for that, and I'd love to be able to give the presentation. Some other events coming up that may interest you are the Customer Experience Strategies Summit, which is happening in Toronto, April 4th to 6th. And I've negotiated a 20% discount for listeners of the Frank Reactions show. So just use the VIP code FRANK20, and I will be there doing some live blogging and tweeting and stuff from the event, as well as doing some interviews that you'll hear in upcoming weeks on the Frank Reactions podcast. And then at the end of that week, on April 8th, I'll be teaching the Metrics Madness half-day intensive course, still in Toronto. So if you went for the conference, just hang on and stay there for the course on Friday. And if you're interested in that, the deadline to register is March 30th. That one you can find at bit.ly/metricsmad. And then one final thing before I get on to today's show. Sorry for all these intros, but there is a lot happening at this time of year. The eTail Canada Conference takes place in Toronto, May 16th to 19th. I've attended that conference a few times before, and this time I will actually be speaking and hope to be able to have the PeopleShock book available for attendees of that conference as well. If you're a retailer, I can offer you a 25% discount. Just use the code EC16FR, and I think those probably all have to be capital letters, at etailca.com. So that's it for the promo announcements. Now let's get into today's podcast. Today my guest is Doug Craig, who is the general manager of the Edmonton Southside Primary Care Network. Healthcare systems worldwide have challenges balancing cost, access, and patient experience. And today's episode is about a new model that's being tested in Alberta, which is called the Primary Care Networks, and about how the patient experience, employee experience, and costs all affect each other. So even if you aren't particularly interested in healthcare itself, I still think you'll find that there's stuff you can learn in here about the interaction among those three elements in any type of organization. Enjoy the interview, and I'll chat with you briefly at the end. What is a primary care network? Because a lot of listeners are not actually in Alberta.
It's a not-for-profit, publicly funded corporation, and the members of our not-for-profit are the family physicians in this area, mm-hmm. and we're funded then to support their primary care practice. In our case, it's to build a medical home, which is a team of allied health professionals practicing at the family medicine clinics to support complex patient care.
So give us an example.
I have a family physician, maybe a group practice of 5 or 6 doctors. Our support would enable them to have an RN on site, a part-time behavioral health consultant, dietitian, respiratory therapist, exercise specialist, and access to group programming that would be an extension of chronic disease care.
And just to make our American listeners jealous, this is all free because it's in our taxes, right?
Well, it's free to the user, but it's
right.
it's funded through the tax base, yes.
That's it, yeah, for sure. So your organization, I mean, it's an exciting business model generally, because as you and I discussed before we started recording, a lot of people do have complex or multiple interacting conditions. And I've literally had a doctor who had a note saying you're only allowed to discuss one issue per visit, which was ridiculous. So this model makes sense in the terms of making things easier, certainly for patients, in that they can access different types of care much more easily and often in the same place, right?
We think it's good from every perspective. It's certainly good from the patient's perspective, because if they have a medical home and they have a primary relationship with a family physician, they get that expanded care of getting the benefit of the scope of practice of all those other practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
They can get better access to the family physician and the clinic in general, because the work is distributed and shared amongst the team, so it's not just one provider providing all the care. We typically find the providers happier because they can delegate some of the work that isn't within their scope of practice.
Yes.
So, you know, the patients benefit. The providers typically have high satisfaction because they can focus on what they're trained to do and what they want to do. They share the workload. So there's greater satisfaction. And in our system, the system is benefiting because we're able to provide extended care to those complex patients that might otherwise have been looking for hospital care or specialty care.
Right.
So we do see it as a win-win-win.
Yeah, and if you're able to offer services like the nutritional counseling or behavioral assistance that will help people lose weight, then they're not going to have all those concomitant problems of diabetes or whatever that go with the weight problem.
That's the ideal. We started with working, when we introduced this model, we started working with the clinics and those patients that were, to continue with your example of diabetes, that were, they had diabetes, they were not well managed, and so the physician brought in the team to help in bringing that population under control as much as possible. But then we expanded to those who were, had the disease but were managing well, just to reinforce the good behaviors and make sure that they continued on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were able to move to those who are at risk of disease and try and do outreach and say, you know, whether it be diet, whether it be exercise, whether it be weight management, all of our part of the problem and part of the solution as well. And so we're able to now get to that entire population. And to your point, are we delaying the onset of some of these costly healthcare consequences of chronic disease? We believe yes, but it's a 25, 30-year project to really know for
right,
sure.
Yeah. What made me want to, as you know, what made me want to turn on the microphone here and chat with you is you've won several Best Employer Awards. You've got how many employees?
About 116.
Wow, okay. And this organization has existed for how long?
11 years.
11 years, okay. I'm interested in what you're doing to build the employee satisfaction and maintain that, because my sense is, and my experience is, that if you've got satisfied employees, you're much more likely to have happy users, or in your case, patients. So I haven't seen patient satisfaction surveys from your organization, so I don't know for sure if that's the case here, but it seems likely. So tell me, what are some of the things that you've done that have won you these Best Employer Awards?
I think there we start with a trust. And it became a required process in what we do, because we work in so many clinics, and we have a nurse working in one clinic and another nurse working in another clinic. The environment that these trained professionals came from was typically a hospital environment where there was a lot of people there, where they had immediate supervision over their work. And you move into a primary care environment and there is no supervision. There is one nurse, one dietitian, one behavioral health consultant. And so they have to be self-starters. They have to be autonomous individuals. They have to have confidence in their skills. They have to be the type of people that can build relationships. And so by default, we had to kind of let them go. And we've all heard the saying of, you know, surround yourself with good people and get out of their way.
Right.
I think we lived that, and we were forced to do that because we couldn't be there managing them every moment of every day. And so the people have reported to us that they have tremendous job satisfaction because of the scope of the work. Mm-hmm. Primary care is not easy. It's everybody and all their problems. So they get challenged professionally.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have the freedom to make autonomous clinical and life choices, We need them to come in early and stay late, depending on what the patient demands are. But it also gives them the ability to get to their kid's Christmas concert because they're managing their own calendar.
Right.
And can have a say in that outcome. And I think all of those combined lead to high satisfaction in the workforce.
So what do you do in the hiring process to make sure you're getting people who really are capable of being self-managed?
We made a transition. When we first started, we were looking for people that had a specific chronic disease experience. We wanted them to have a clinical skill. And while that's still true today, we know we can teach the clinical skill. And if somebody comes in and they're a registered professional, they have the foundation for what we need them to do. And if there's a particular piece of that that they haven't gained through their own practice, we can help them get it.
Right.
But we really do now look at those qualities of self. Are you a self-starter? Are you an independent worker? Do you have confidence? All very difficult to quantify in a recruitment process. So a lot of time spent on interviewing, a lot of time spent on reference checking. And of course, we continually evolve our practice even through orientation and training, where orientation started out being very clinical to where it's now very much get somebody in a clinic and really see how they engage with the practice.
And what try, do you mean?
Can they build relationships?
Okay.
Can they get comfortable working with the other care providers and the admin staff in the practice? That now becomes more important than can they start somebody on insulin?
Right, yeah.
Because that's the technical skill that we can teach.
Absolutely. Have you found any kind of challenges in finding the right people?
From time to time, when the organization was young, we weren't well known, and so people were reluctant to come, thinking it's rather a high risk. We might be over that hump, but we're still a very small player in a very big healthcare system.
Right.
And so it's not the place for everybody. And now our challenges are, can we find people with the right ethnic and language skills at times in order to meet all of the community needs at a practice?
So you have to do some targeted recruiting within certain communities,
right.
I guess.
Yes.
And you've started doing that?
Yeah, I think we've got 13 or 14 languages that are now spoken by our staff.
Wow. And so you've got people who all essentially report to you, but they're spread out in different physical locations.
Yeah.
So how do you supervise? How do you make sure that things are going well?
The org structure we've evolved is one where we have primary care managers who they themselves are clinicians.
Okay.
And we ask anybody in our organization that has a clinical designation to maintain a clinical practice.
Okay.
And our primary care managers work at least one day a week in a clinic in their discipline. And the rest of the time, they're managers who have responsibility for getting to the clinics and making sure that our staff, their teams, are getting what they need, being supported, and are integrating into that practice.
It's interesting, you're saying that they have to maintain the clinical practice one day a week. Why do you do that?
They need to know what the issues are. They need to understand the complexities of working in a family practice environment.
Okay.
And so we do that. I think one other thing we've done is that we don't believe one profession is any different or better than another. And
now that's a shock. A lot of doctors might dispute that.
But they all have a role to play.
Absolutely.
Or they wouldn't be there, right?
The
scopes of practice are different.
Yeah.
And so, for example, our team right now, I think, has 7 or 8 different health disciplines on it. And the 6 primary care managers that we have represent those different disciplines. And their teams their teams are multidisciplinary.
Right.
So social workers don't have social work managers. Nurses don't have nurse managers. The team may have a social work manager. And in that team, you've got all of the disciplines. And so it is about integration and respect and about collaboration. And so we try and walk the talk. Our primary care managers are multidisciplinary, and they lead multidisciplinary teams.
That's interesting. So have you noticed any differences in the way they tend to approach the job based on what their discipline background is?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And I think the nursing is a little more closely related to the physician practice because of the medical component.
Right.
And the social workers, really have a you know, bent for mental health and community supports and services. So they all have a different perspective on it. But if we can be truly patient-centered, then it's about what does the patient need and when do they need it and who's best able to provide it. In fact, we've even gone through examples where a dietitian was a little bit concerned that a nurse was providing nutrition education because of the boundary concerns.
Right.
And the bottom line was, is the nurse giving inaccurate information? If the answer is no, then the nurse can do that within their scope of practice. So as long as you're qualified to do it, there are no boundaries.
Hmm, okay.
So we've evolved through that. I don't think we see that anymore. Now we do understand that everybody and anybody can provide professional care if they're qualified and competent to do it. And we see that mental health is a great example. Certainly our mental health providers, our behavioral health consultants, see the majority of the mental health care in our system. But when we look at our data at the year end, nurses have provided mental health support, dietitians have provided mental health support, exercise specialists have provided mental health support, because it depends on when the need arises.
Yeah.
And if that person that's there can add value, you do it now, you do it in the moment, and you care for that patient in a holistic fashion.
So are there like weekly team meetings or something where they discuss the current patient load? How do you do that?
That would be done at the clinic level.
Okay.
Because each clinic then has its own panel of patients that they're responsible for.
Okay. But does every clinic have every discipline or no?
They have access to every discipline.
Okay.
But depending on the size of the practice, the number of hours the discipline's there may vary.
So there would be, let's say, nurses potentially working in more than one clinic within the network?
More likely with the other professions.
Yeah, I guess.
Nursing is more apt to be full-time, but the other the professions. Respiratory therapy, it's something you can... People with pulmonary disease, you can batch them and have a half-day clinic, and the respiratory therapist can come in and deal with all of the issues all at one time and then go to another practice.
Right. How do you assess patient satisfaction with the service they're getting?
First of all, there's a language shift in that. It's now not patient satisfaction. Patient satisfaction is very relevant to the health system.
Okay.
And people that are in very poor countries and poor systems with very poor health systems actually rate very high in satisfaction because their expectations
are so low.
And conversely, those of us in the Western world typically are dissatisfied and we've got great systems. So the language is patient experience.
Okay.
And what you're typically measuring is, how long did you have to wait to get an appointment? And do you feel you got the care that you needed? So it's a twist on satisfaction, but it's about experience.
Yeah, we say that with customer experience too.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. But it's more about figuring out, did they get in when they needed to get in?
Right.
And is the biggest thing. And for the most part, the results are pretty good. I don't have any current patient experience results to show you.
But is that something that you...
It is, but we do it every second year, every second or third year, because the changes don't take...
Sure.
We can't impact change so quickly.
Right, okay. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've had in getting this going and in running it currently?
Great question, Tama. I think it's the getting comfortable at the physician end to working in a team.
Mm-hmm.
Family physicians typically are independent practitioners, and they have responsibility for the full clinical service provided to a patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so letting go of some of those responsibilities takes a little while. And so we have to earn their trust. And with that trust then comes a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more, a little bit more. So it takes a while to overcome that.
But they've chosen voluntarily to be part of it, have they?
They have.
Yeah, okay.
But the process of, I want to do this, actually doing it takes
for
some time.
Okay. Right?
I think we keep evolving our model, and that then is, I think, coming back to the staff issue, it's an area of constant change. we never seem to be settled. We're always saying, hey, we're doing it right.
Yeah.
Is there a better way to do this?
Yeah. Do you help in terms of administrative overhead provision as well, or does each physician still have responsibility for running his clinic with a receptionist? I shouldn't say his. I know that a lot of the grads now are her.
Yeah.
Who's responsible for that kind of thing?
The clinic is still an independent autonomous practice, so we're coming in and helping on the clinical side only.
Okay. Okay. So you're basically giving them access to a bunch of other professionals.
That's right.
Right. Right.
And the challenge is in the integration. Space is a problem. Mm-hmm. Family physician clinics are built for family physicians because they're the ones paying the freight, right?
Right.
So there's typically two exam rooms and common area space. Mm-hmm. And one doctor, 10 doctors, they all look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So when you bring in a team of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, where do they work?
Yeah. So how do they deal with that?
We get very creative. We typically can find some unused space. We have people that literally have worked in broom closets. physician schedules can often be, so-and-so's not here Wednesday afternoon, mm-hmm. And we'll use that space. And in some cases, we've actually renovated clinics. We haven't increased the footprint. We've just tried to improve the flow and the utilization.
Okay.
And for some clinics, they've gone the extra mile themselves and said, this is working so well, we don't want to lose it. They've done renovations. They've taken on more space to accommodate the team. So we know we've really made that transition to a medical home model when the physicians themselves make those investments.
So from the physician's perspective, does being part of this make it possible for them to essentially have more billable hours because some of their time is freed up by others doing stuff that they would have?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's the key benefit apart from personal satisfaction.
Yeah, I think that the patients are benefiting because there's better access and improved and better, more comprehensive care through the team.
Mm-hmm.
The physicians, I think, can be more efficient because they can delegate some of that and where maybe an appointment, a complex patient appointment used to be half an hour, it's now 15 and they can see another patient, so there's another opportunity for them. And again, our health system in general is benefiting by more access to the system. So I think regardless of the perspective we put on this, that there is a reason to do it from everybody's point of view.
For sure. Do you find that patients do they ever get the sense that they no longer have as much of a relationship with their physician? Does it bother them sometimes being shunted off to another person?
Not that we've heard, and what we have heard is quite the contrary.
Okay.
We had one physician report that they used to come in saying, I'm looking for my doctor, and now they come in and say, I'm looking for my nurse. Mm. And the physician reported that to us and thought that was a fabulous transition.
Yeah.
That another relationship, an important care relationship, was formed in the practice.
Right.
And by having the care at the family physician's practice, that it's still under their banner.
Right.
There's a trust and a credibility and a reassurance when somebody comes in to see a nurse or an RT or these other providers. There's far fewer no-shows.
Right.
And far better uptake of the information they get.
That's interesting, the point about no-shows. So there's sort of this assumed respect that they're getting that's sort of spread out, a halo effect.
Could be, yeah. There's that connection to the family physician remains, and it is still core to the primary care service.
That's very cool. Is there anything I should have asked you and I haven't?
No, you've asked some good questions.
There are certain lessons that came out in today's interview that I really think apply in almost any business. Things like avoiding micromanaging, understanding what your frontline folks are really experiencing by sending some of the people who aren't on the front lines there to experience it in real life on a pretty regular basis, and encouraging staff to help meet customer needs in the moment, even if it means stepping a bit beyond their formal job description, and also developing an atmosphere where nobody inside is going to get upset at them for doing that. Next week, I will have an interview with Dan Weber of iTrax about some new developments in mobile market research that can really help you understand your customers and prospects better. So stay tuned for that next week. Meanwhile, to get a transcript of today's episode, just head on over to frankreactions.com/65, as the number, not spelt out. And I'll also have all the other links that I mentioned at the start of this episode there, including the one to become a PeopleShock Insider, which I'd be thrilled if you'd like to do. And just in case you don't want to go back to the page for it, I'll remind you now that one is bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst, all as one word in lowercase. That's all I've got for today. As always, I would be thrilled if you would head over to iTunes and leave a review, or if that's too much hassle, and it certainly can be if you're not already listening in iTunes, just call and leave a message toll-free in North America at 1-866-544-9262. and I can play that at the beginning of next week's episode or whatever week you decide to do it. I'd also love to get your feedback on this and any other episodes or any of the writing that I'm doing. You can reach me at any time simply by emailing Tema, T-E-M as in marketing, A, at frankreactions.com. You can also find me on Twitter simply at Tema Frank and on LinkedIn and all the other basic places you would expect. Have a wonderful week, and I will chat with you again next week. Bye.